This is a special podcast in the ongoing series of WQXR.org's Conducting Business. I'm Jeff Spurgeon. It's an old romantic notion. You walk into your local record store and ask the ornery old clerk which version of the Sibelius Second Symphony is worth your hard-earned cash. After lots of debate over the merits of Carrion versus Bernstein or Schulte, you decide on your purchase and you rush home and pop it into your stereo. Well, those were the old days. Everything's changed. Tower Records folded in 2006. Virgin Megastore, HMV, Barnes & Noble at Lincoln Center, and most recently Borders, all followed suit. But with a click of a mouse these days, you can access a host of internet services, including iTunes and Archive Music and Amazon, and most recently in the U.S., Spotify. Now, often the prices for recordings are significantly better, but is the classical music fan better off? That's the question. Is the act of discovering and buying music better than it used to be? It's certainly different. Here to talk about it today are three guests. Anastasia Tsoulkas is a writer at NPR Music. Gene Cook is the director of programs at the Future of Music Coalition, which is an advocacy group for musicians. And on the phone with us from London is Andy Doe, chief operating officer at Naxos Records and former head of classical music at iTunes. Welcome, one and all.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This is a pleasure.
Anastasia, we'll start with you. In a week, Borders closes, and the online music service Spotify launches its U.S. store. What does this suggest to you? We've reached a turning point, but what's going to happen?
Well, I think the Borders failure is something that people within the classical music community, certainly on the label side, had anticipated and expected for quite some time now. The only question was really when, not what if. It's what it is with the closing of Borders is the closing of one of the very last brick-and-mortar storefronts that carried any classical music. There were some great locations within the Borders chain that they were very knowledgeable about classical music and very happy to talk and interact with customers in a very personal way. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case for the chain as a whole. It was very soulless. However, it was still one of the very few remaining places where classical labels could put their CDs into the marketplace and get them exposure on a national level.
Well, let's talk then just very quickly about another broad question. Who wins, who loses in this change, in this sea change?
It shifts consumers back to maybe their local record shops, if they still exist, if they do still enjoy that experience of browsing through the racks and discovering things in a sort of idle discovery. Does anyone lose? Sure. If you live where Borders was the closest place to go buy music and you still want to be that consumer who looks for things in physical format, absolutely, you're the loser. Who's the winner? It's hard to say. I don't think that we're talking about a situation in which you can say all of those consumers are going to go to digital outfits, that they're going to go to iTunes or eMusic or Archive Music or Ariama or any of the places that sell physical CDs online. Because what I think people are finding is that it's a different consumer. The people who buy downloads are not necessarily the people who want to buy CDs. And the classical consumers who still buy CDs for all kinds of reasons, sound quality, liner notes, you know, sort of the visceral experience of holding a recording in your hands, those consumers are not necessarily going to say, I'm totally happy with a digital download. And my understanding from my sources at classical labels is that only half of their audiences buy music online. The other half are still buying physical CDs.
All right. Andy, we did a non-scientific survey here at WQXR on our website about preferred recording formats, and it reflects some of what Anastasia said. A whopping 78% of our respondents, an unscientific poll, still prefer CDs, 13% like downloads. Why is this? Is it just because we like what we already know? And you would have a perspective on this, having worked for the big downloading organization iTunes and also for the big CD organization Naxos.
I think it's fair to say that your audience isn't necessarily representative of the broader music buying public as a whole.
Including the broader classical music buying public?
Perhaps they're more representative of the broader classical music buying public. When we look at the music market as a whole, 52% of the music sold in America in the first half of this year was sold digitally and not physically.
And when you say that, you mean that those were people who bought music files, computer files. They didn't buy CDs online. We should make that distinction?
That's correct. That's digital downloads where there was no physical product purchased.
Right.
It's just over half of all the music bought. That's counting units.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the ways to discover music. Gene, you found that the ability to find music through online services is deeply flawed. We mentioned this a little bit earlier. Let's talk about metadata now. What is metadata, and why do you need it, and what's wrong with it, and the way that classical music is sold with it?
Before the internet, when you wanted to buy a record, you would go to a store, you would browse, you'd talk to people about it, and you'd be able to see the record there, and you'd be able to kind of touch it and look at the artwork, and you'd be able to see other recordings that may have been grouped together. That is the ideal experience that people are going for, I think, online. But the way these structures are being built, you're not necessarily able to see the record anymore. You're really relying on the information that gets transmitted with the digital recording. And that information would include things like who is the artist, what is the title of the track, and who is the label. And with classical music, it's a little bit tricky because if you ask somebody who's the artist or what is the title of a track, you might come up with many different answers. An artist could potentially be the composer, for example. In the case of a recording of a Beethoven symphony, let's say Symphony No. 9, you would have all of the soloists, you'd have the orchestra, you'd have the conductor, and you'd have the person who composed the work. All of those people could be considered artists, but in many cases, there's just one field when you're looking in the digital world for figuring out who that person is. Title of the track has a similar problem. Symphonies come in movements if there are four or five movements. And also with classical music, movement titles tend to be fairly generic. So if you go to iTunes and you search for the title of a track called Adagio, for example, you might end up with, I don't know, Andy could probably tell you kind of how many, but I would imagine thousands of recordings. And they would be, you listen to one, it might be a piano sonata, you listen to another, it might be a string quartet. You can't really distinguish by the title track. So it becomes very important when you're thinking about how you deliver classical music, how you annotate all of these things. The data that comes with the music file is typically, I guess, in the industry called metadata. And that's something that as we've been moving towards a digital marketplace, standards have not really been set. So there are a lot of different folks who are providing this information to the services, whether they be an aggregator like IOTA, who works with many different record labels. Some larger record labels will work directly with a lot of music services, or it might even be an outside library of information that people like iTunes might go to get information about the tracks to provide kind of alongside the actual music. All of those folks are not necessarily coordinating because this is, you know, a lot of the stuff that happens in the internet is quite chaotic and kind of happens from the ground up. There isn't really a room somewhere where three people get together and say, this is how we're going to talk about classical music when we deliver the data to services. Nobody's really kind of coordinating. And as a result, it's very difficult as a classical music consumer, which in addition to being a musician, I go out and buy records quite a lot online to find things.
Andy Doe, who is with Nexus now, you were with iTunes before. iTunes has been around for 9 years or something like this, and you were helping with the classical music there. What did you do about solving this problem, or what didn't get done at iTunes, and why not, to get a standardized set of data that would help people search for classical music?
Well, this is an interesting question. While I was at iTunes, I worked very hard to make sure that the metadata that we displayed was consistent, did include the full list of artist names, not as a single long compound artist, but as a person called Herbert von Karajan and the Berlin Philharmonic, but as a separate list of people that you could click on and see all of their work. But we also made sure that wherever possible, you were able to see the extremely long album titles, track titles, and lists of artists. But to a certain extent, I think this is a problem which wrongly obsesses a lot of people in the classical music world. If you look at where people actually download music from, the vast majority of it is from stores which are mainstream music providers like iTunes and Amazon, and not specialist stores like Classics Online, Classical Archives, Ariama, Archive Music. And although some of these stores do quite well, what the market's telling us is that people are able to find an enormous amount of classical music on mainstream stores like iTunes. And I slightly disagree with Gene's example of being able to easily find something in a physical record store compared with on iTunes. If you're looking for a specific work, as Gene said, do you look under the composer's name, under S? Do you look under violin? Do you go and look in every single box set in the store to see whether or not that work is included in that box set? And if you want to purchase that work, you have to buy the entire box set if you find it. In fact, a physical record store is appallingly laid out and is only indexed by one factor. Things are shelved according to however the people in the record store decided to shelve them. And a recording isn't filed both under the artist and under the instrument and under the composer. It's in one place or the other. In digital stores like iTunes, you can find it under all of those things, and you can search for it. And I think if we were to take my laptop to the largest classical record department we could find and have a race to see who could find the most recordings of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony in the store that we're in and on iTunes, I'm pretty sure that the laptop would win.
This isn't necessarily, though, about a competition between iTunes and the old-school record store. This is about how the potential of the Internet really isn't living up to itself quite yet because of a number of very complex transactions that aren't quite happening.
That's true. And there are stores which address the specific needs of classical music purchasers. Naxos runs Classics Online. We also have Naxos Music Library. There's Classical Archives. There's Archive Music. There's Ariama. There are lots of stores that have done an enormous amount of work individually to provide all of this data to consumers. As Gene says, there isn't currently a good standard for exchanging that data between us.
I just want to jump in here, if I may, Andy, and say there's actually one thing that I find fascinating about the online experience that harkens back not to the days necessarily of even Tower, but even going back a few decades earlier, which is you get to hear a bit of the music before you buy, I would challenge anyone to have walked into HMV and walk up to the clerk and say, open this for me, I'd like to hear a bit, which is certainly something that the online services offer. And that creates a wonderful avenue for discovery and for exploration.
So that's an advantage.
That's very true.
How did you handle this at what was the firm that you worked with, Anastasia?
I used to be at an online store called Ariama before I joined NPR as their editor. And essentially, it's very much on a similar model to other stores that Andy has mentioned, and sells both CDs and digital downloads, of high-quality digital downloads. So we were getting as good metadata as possible from the labels and worked very hard with our label contacts to make sure that they were delivering good information and simply rebuilding where we needed to, and having teams of people do that, which is extremely time intensive and extremely resource intensive for anyone. And I wager to guess that all of these specialty services are doing that and sort of like everybody in their own cells recreating the wheel, which is, you know, to some good and to some detriment.
Well, that's to Gene's point that if there were standards set up for recording metadata, then we could do it once, or we could take a recording and do it once and it would work for every online store, and that would solve that problem. I will tell you that here at the radio station, we have exactly the same problem, because if you have two people entering a recording into our library, and they put quotations around a movement, the name of a movement, which it might be a standard, we can't search for it the same way. So we won't find all the recordings of a recording we have. Because
it's functionally gone.
Yeah, it's a very complex problem in the classical music world. All right, with these problems and some advantages, including the ability to sample a work online, discussed. Now, let me ask you this. What we started out in this conversation was with the premise that you'd go into Tower and you'd find the guy or the woman in the classical department who you trusted and knew. They were a little off, maybe, just as individuals, but they had a deep knowledge and love of classical music and could help you with recordings. How do I, as a consumer now in the online world, recreate that experience? I can't get the smell of the mildewy carpet that I used to get in a classical music store, but can I find any way to get an experienced clerk to help me in the online situation?
Well, that points to kind of the other side of the online stores. You know, there's the mechanical part of, like, can you actually search for things when you want to? But you can't build a store simply as a search kind of tool to find things, because most people don't necessarily know what it is that they want to find. I think that in this room we have three examples of people who maybe go into stores and know exactly what they want, but we're definitely not typical. And that's why editorial becomes extremely important. Curators become extremely important. And working in radio, I'm sure you understand, you know, radio programmers serve a similar purpose where they give context for things. They help people to explore individual performers, individual composers, or different kinds of scenes or movements within music that people can explore and kind of hold on to and learn more about.
Thank you for understanding what we do. It's so touching to feel valued. Thank you so much, Gene. No, you're exactly right. We know that we have that counterpart. But again, online, very hard to do this.
Well, most services, I mean, when I was talking earlier about how some services will try and get information about recordings from places like Grace Note or All Music Guide, they're doing that so they can provide some editorial content that can give some context to the music that people are trying to purchase or trying to learn more about. There's a partnership that happens there. A lot of places like iTunes, you know, they will have a curatorial staff that'll say, you know, this is the pick of the week. Rhapsody does the same thing. They have an editorial team that writes about things and offers a perspective on new releases. NPR does the same thing. Ariama does the same thing. That I think that's an integral part of the business plan.
Right. And yet, Andy, it's interesting that you say that people are buying lots of classical music without that experience necessarily. So there are some people who go into the record store and aren't as interested in knowing if this is the fourth recording that Carrión made of this particular piece. They just like the stuff that sounds pretty. Am I right?
Well, I don't know that people shopping in physical record stores approach things that differently. I don't know that I've ever walked into a physical record store and learned that a particular CD was the fourth recording that Carrión made of a piece of music. And I think we have to remember that technology gives as well as takes away in this instance, that what the internet has taken away in the form of the physical retail experience, it's replaced with message boards and with social media. And we have lots of other opportunities to discover music. I think that what YouTube has done for music discovery far outweighs what we've lost by being able to go into a room that smells of mildewy carpet and ask somebody's personal opinion. You know, we get to experience these things for ourselves, which I think is infinitely more valuable than being able to obtain received opinion from a record store clerk.
Anastasia Tsoulkas, what are the readers of NPR's music website saying about this issue?
I think we recently ran a piece about the borders issue, and we've certainly started talking about Spotify as well. And the response that we've had on the border subject has been very much a split between the people who said that was the place where I went, either I went last week or I went 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and I'll miss it, and it was an integral part of my experience of discovering music. And the people say, yeah, you know, I don't buy from there anymore anyway. I would never step foot in a store like that. I would never go in with the intention of buying music in the first place, so it's not a great loss to me. Just adding on to Andy's point about crowdsourcing and YouTube and social media, I'm having a lot of fun personally on Spotify examining the playlists that other people are putting together.
Let's talk just for a brief moment about what Spotify is. It is a new online store, previously not available in the United States.
Right. New to us.
And yes, exactly. And it does sort of what iTunes does, which is it sells music, but with a different business model, or it offers music online with a different business model.
There are tiers. There's a free version that has ads embedded in it, but there are additional levels that are ad-free, or you can take on your mobile device, say on your iPhone or what have you. But it's all streaming, and the idea is that you can approach music and discover music in forms of playlists. Now, I could make, let's go back to the Carrión example, because he's our hero of the day. I could make an all Carrión playlist and share it with other people. One of our more industrious fans in Beijing actually put together a playlist based on NPR recommended list. So we did a series a couple of years ago of 50 great voices across all genres, and he took those recommendations and put them into a Spotify playlist, and did the same thing for some of our classical cornerstone repertoire as well. It's a way of sort of sharing music listening to music on streaming, but also sharing music.
Gene Cook with the Future of Music Coalition, and a musicians advocacy organization. You can't be happy about this idea, can you? Because where do the musicians get any pay for their work?
Well, I want to back up for 1 second to the playlist thing, because I just want to put a finer point on what Anastasia was saying, which is that now music fans can all become curators. I mean, that's really the value of the playlist. And the idea that you don't necessarily have to download the file, you don't have to have 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 gigabytes worth of music on your hard drive and then try and figure out how to get it on your phone. All of that stuff is in the cloud with Spotify, and you're able to kind of stream it. That's one of the benefits of this new business model. It's a slight tweak on the old one, but I think that it's one that's probably going to lead to more adoption. With the question about how musicians get paid, you are right. Musicians get paid a different rate for downloads than they do for streaming. And I think that's one of the reasons why Spotify took a long time to kind of acquire all the licenses that they needed to operate in the United States. The general trend towards streaming is something that a lot of folks in the music industry are very concerned about, because it generally does reduce the amount of money that ends up going to the artist. But I have to say, for a niche genre like classical music, well, first of all, there's very little you can do about the fact that things are headed in that direction. But what you can do something about is making sure that when you're trying to figure out who played on a recording so you can get the person paid, that the information is there. And that kind of takes us back to the metadata question. One of the reasons why FMC was looking at that particular issue, while it is annoying as a classical fan to not be able to find things the way I want to and as quickly as I want to, there is a larger kind of underlying concern on a policy level that classical musicians, if you can't attach the name of the performer or the name of the composer appropriately to a piece of music, when it comes time to pay that person for sales or uses in general, you can't find them.
Andy Doe of Naxos and formerly of iTunes, what does Spotify mean to the organization you work for now and the organization you used to work for? They are competitors, I presume.
I think iTunes and Spotify would look at each other partly as competitors and partly as enjoying a symbiotic relationship wherein people have the opportunity to discover music on Spotify and purchase it on iTunes. But from the Naxos perspective, we look at Spotify as a customer, just as we look at iTunes or Amazon or eMusic as customers.
So the direction is up?
The direction is definitely up for Spotify. And the thing you have to remember when information starts to emerge about the slow uptake of Spotify subscriptions in the United States, as I suspect it probably will, is that it takes a long time for somebody to move from being a user of the free Spotify subscription to really thinking it's worth paying the money to subscribe. This is the lesson about subscription services that Spotify learned and that its competitors hadn't learned up to this point, that it takes people a long time to completely change the way they consume music. And the subscription model is a fundamental change to the way that people consume music. So it took a long time for people to get used to it. But they enjoyed the free service on Spotify, and after about a year, they started to see very real numbers of people subscribing to it. And now in many European countries, Spotify subscriptions are generating a significant quantity of revenue.
One of the new issues is the quality of music that's available through a download. Sometimes you buy a track from a service and you get lousy audio quality, a poorly uploaded recording or a poor recording to begin with. How do we as consumers judge the quality of the downloads that we're purchasing or the streaming service that we're subscribing to?
The real quality that people who care about these sort of things digitally have been looking for are lossless, it's called, or FLAC is the acronym, another acronym that's in fairly common usage, that is essentially higher than your standard MP3 format. Now, I would venture to say that digital audio quality has become something of a fetish for a lot of listeners that doesn't have that much basis in reality, because most people don't have audio equipment at home or wherever they're listening that would be able to distinguish the difference. Anytime you hear anything on the radio, it's a compressed file. You know, it's a compression. So if you're okay with radio, you'll probably be okay with...
Oh, you're okay with radio.
I love our member stations.
Thank you. Thank you.
But what I'm getting at is, for most people, you know, radio is a wonderful standard. You know, that an MP3, a high quality 320, say 320 kpbs, would be just fine, more than fine, in fact.
So where do each of you think we'll wind up? Because we've definitely left the shore of recorded music on flat platters of one sort or another. And we're now negotiating rough technological change waters. But the other shore, where is it? What will it be? Will we just have music on a device? Will we ever own anything? Or will we just stream it with a subscription service?
Well, you're speaking to somebody who's got 42 feet of LPs at home, including shellac. And I consume however I consume. One thing that I do hope that eventually we will get to is a way for me to hear all of the records that I have amassed over the years, whenever I want. And that's something that I think a lot, that's kind of the holy grail when you think about music services, and that's what people are trying to work towards. Whether or not it ends up being integrated in the way that I need it to as a music fan with my particular tastes, I don't know if it'll get there, but I think that that's the general trend that we're seeing. To be able to hear music on any device at any time, stuff that you either own yourself or things that you make that are made available to you by cloud services like Spotify.
Thank you, Jean Cook. Anastasia Tsoulkas.
I think it's really about a panoply of options for various reasons. I don't think that any of us are typical music consumers by any stretch.
I don't think there's anybody who's a typical
music
consumer.
That's absolutely true, but I think some of us are fussier.
Are more atypical than others.
And more voracious than others. Let's put it that way. But I think that what Jean is saying has a lot of validity. I think that there certainly is going to be an audience for people who want a fidelity, an audio, a sonic fidelity that goes beyond what most people have access to on their mobile devices or even on their laptops or what have you. I think that it would be lovely for all the online services, whether it's downloading or streaming, to create something of the same experience, not just listening experience, but the complete experience that you can look at libretti, that you can read liner notes, that you can see the album artwork.
Andy Doe, where are we headed?
This is a question that people often ask me, and I think this is because I've done a very good job of getting myself hired by companies that turned out to be the right move. But I'm very reluctant to make predictions about the future. I'm much more interested in having an accurate picture of where we are now. I think, though, when we look back at the developments over the last few years, what we see is a move in the direction of convenience. And this is where consumers really win, that it's becoming easier and easier to find, to obtain, to consume, to use music. And I think that's a trend that we'll certainly see continue in the years to come. And it's very much driven by a market that wants to be able to consume music their way. And I think that's good news for all of us.
I would just want to reinforce, I mean, I agree with what Andy is saying, but I also want to reinforce kind of what Anastasia was saying. I mean, the future is that there isn't going to be one future. There's going to be many different futures. In the research that I've seen, the vast majority of classical music consumers listen to the radio in the background when they're at work or something like that, or in the car. And then there are the people who have the 7-foot-tall speakers that are just so arranged so they can sit down on their couch and listen to the Philadelphia Orchestra, and it sounds like the Philadelphia Orchestra is in their living room.
Or it's even better than actually
Philadelphia because you don't have to deal with the people coughing right next to you. So, I mean, and all of those people, you know, the people who buy vinyl, the crazy people like me who buy 78s, the people who want to hear things as conveniently as possible and don't care about quality, I think there's a place for all of those people in the future.
Well, we've certainly brought you a lot of data today, meta and otherwise, on the topic of the shifting sands of music retail in the world. And I want to thank all three of our panelists. You've been listening to WQXR.org's Conducting Business podcast on the state of music retail with Anastasia Tsoulkas from NPR Music and Jean Cook from the Future of Music Coalition and Andy Doe from Naxos Records. Our producer's Brian Wise. Bill O'Neill has engineered this little affair. I'm Jeff Spurgeon. Thanks to you for listening. We invite your comments on our website at WQXR.org and ask you to keep an eye out on the website for another podcast as well. Thanks very much.